in it for the kicks back in my day.
Josh Abrahams, he began his electronic music career as a techno producer in Melbourne, Australia, around about the early 90s, as part of the group The Future Sound of Melbourne, signing to Carl Cox's label at the time, Worldwide Ultimatum Records. Now, towards the end of the millennium, Josh became a huge fan of the big beat sound. Who didn't, really? And he began experimenting with different tempos of breakbeat. A chance meeting with the vocalist, Amiel Damien, and the anthem Addicted to Bass was penned. In New Zealand in 1999, the track became a commercial hit, and in Australia, it was nominated for 5 ARIA Awards, winning 2 for Best Independent Release and Best Dance Artist Album. It was released to the rest of the world in the year 2001 under the name of Pure Tone, where it debuted at number 2 in the pop singles charts and cemented its place in dance music history. I loved the tune, so I went and hunted down Josh for a bit of a catch-up and for him to recall the success of Addicted to Bass.
My intro to music was sort of quirky pop, I guess, Devo, and of course Kraftwerk, like every electronic musician. But I certainly wasn't interested in dance music really at all, disco or any of that stuff. Didn't really like it at all in my school years or even in my uni years. But sort of towards the end of uni, I started going to raves and wanted to, you know, work out how to make this music. So I met up with a couple of DJs, and it turned out they wanted to be making the music as well. So me and myself and David Carboni and Steve Robbins, two of the sort of main techno DJs, guys who brought techno to Melbourne, we formed a group in the early 90s or even late 80s called FSOM, Future Sound of Melbourne. And through them, you know, sort of the filter of their very, very strong and particular taste filter, I learned a lot about what could work into a sort of techno audience, or, you know, techno was our style. We weren't really club music. We were more sort of underground rave music. So that was my sort of dance music upbringing. But while I was working with the guys in Future Sound of Melbourne, I was also kind of also always working on my own thing as well, which veered more towards pop, I guess, in that there was often vocals, or, you know, at least a vocal sample, and there was a whole range of products, projects. I was working as I would come across various singers, and we would develop projects together. There was something called the Edison Project, with a singer called Susie Ahern. We did this kind of breakbeat track, I guess you'd call it, called Don't Be Afraid to Think for Yourself. Another track with a friend of mine, Lani, called You're My 303, which was a pretty banging acid track, of course. And then, as well as that, I was still developing my own personal techno music. And in, I think it was 94, Carl Cox came to town, as he kind of did or does every year still, and I had the good chance to meet him. He was playing an FSOM 12-inch called Shivaratri, I think he was playing, and he wanted to meet the guy, so we met him, and we got on very well. I really liked him, and I decided at some point I would send him some of my own music, which I did do, and followed it up, and really it was kind of a lot of it was good timing. I think I got through to his, you know, the people at his label when he'd just signed a big distribution deal with a major European distributor, and they needed an album for that summer, and I said, you know, have you got that album I sent you? And I said, oh, here it is, and I listened to it, got back to me and said, great, this is going to be our first album release on our new label, Worldwide Ultimatum Records. So that was, you know, pretty amazing. I think it was 1996. I got to go to the UK for a month and kind of hang out with Carl and get the album mastered and go to his gigs and do all the press and stuff for the album. So that was really an amazing experience, really great journey. And that friendship and working relationship with Carl has continued on all the way through to now. One of the most recent projects we just did in Samplify was Carl has just released a collection of loops for, you know, for music producers and DJs and stuff, and we produced that for him. So, you know, it was sort of under his style guide and guidance, and working with Carl in the studio. It took us about 6 months. So it was a very long term project, and we produced this sort of 1.5 gigabytes of loops. That's been an amazing kind of relationship for me in my dance music career. So the story of Addicted to Bass is that I guess, you know, towards the end of the 90s, I was moving away from techno, and I was a real, really big fan of the Chemicals, a huge fan of the Chemical Brothers, a huge fan of the early Fatboy Slim stuff, which, and I guess the whole breakbeat movement and big beat movement as well. So I had pretty much all of my releases had come out on Shock Records over the years, both mine and Future Sound of Melbourne. It got to the point where I was talking to Shock Records about an album release, for my own album, a sort of independent album release separate from the band. And I'd done a big beat track called Thrill Seeker, which was the first single off the album here, and I may have been in New Zealand, which went quite well. It was played a lot on Triple J here. You know, it was played sort of nationwide for a good few months, and people knew it, and it was kind of used in ads on TV and stuff. And as I was developing the album, I had been listening a lot to a cassette that one of my best friends who had moved to London, Tony, had sent me this cassette, and he'd written on it, "Check this." And what it was a very, 90-minute cassette, because back in those days we still had cassettes, of pirate, London pirate drum and bass radio, or jungle, in fact. It was jungle back then. It was just wild stuff. It was just, 90 minutes of mind-blowing material that was just really tough and hard and really the kind of the raw bleeding edge of what drum and bass was at that time. And then on the radio, often they were playing, they'd say, "Oh, here's the new, drum and bass track." And it was very jazzy and soft and smooth. And that really bothered me. And I kind of got it in my head. I said, I really want to show them what drum and bass is. It's not this soft stuff. It's meant to tear the speakers open. So I kind of came to writing this track, Addicted to Bass, or a drum and bass track anyway, with the view of I wanted to use the tough, tearing sounds that I knew so well from techno, but use them in that kind of, that tempo, that 165 tempo, 165 BPM, and in that drum and bass kind of breakbeat context. So that was the sort of the aim, I guess, or the motivation for doing the track. I think the Addicted to Bass, I was just in the car and I heard Huey Lewis singing Addicted to Love, and I thought, well, what am I addicted to? And I thought, well, I'm addicted to bass, because I was, whenever, through my whole kind of career or my fandom career, listening to pop growing up through high school, I was always singing along with the bass line. I was obsessed with The Police, and it was mostly Sting's bass playing that I was obsessed with, and I had become obsessed with Beatles through university, and it was Paul McCartney's bass playing and that very melodic bass playing. And even in my time as a raver, I was always singing along with the bass line. It sort of came naturally to say, well, Huey Lewis is addicted to love, I'm addicted to bass. So I had this idea that I want a drum and bass tempo, I want it to be tough and hard, I'll show them all, I thought to myself. And at the same time, I had met up with this young singer who, in one of my jobs in the studio, because at this stage I was producing for a lot of demos for singers and just had people coming through the studio all the time, had this fairly crazy dude called Lokananda, who would greet me at the front door with saying, Rama, with a little bow, and doing this kind of like Madonna, but with a guy singing, I guess, sort of, house music or commercial house music or something. But he brought along this young girl, I described her very unfairly at the time as rave trash, to the studio to do backing vocals, and I thought, oh God, she clearly hadn't been to sleep the night before. She was kind of pretty wasted and pretty tired, and she seemed like, a little kid. And I thought, why is he wasting my time with this kid? And she got behind the mic and absolutely blew my mind. She did a first take, and I didn't even know what to say. It was perfect. And I said to her, well, let's do another take. She said, sure. And that one matched the first one perfectly, and I just panned them left and right, and that was it. And she came into the studio, back into the control room, and I said to her, are you interested in a career in music? She said, oh, yeah. I said, because you've got one right now if you want it. So this, this young sort of rave trash, inverted commas, vocalist turned out to be this very talented young singer and songwriter, Amiel Damien. you know, after sort of offering her this career, we sat down and we worked together. She showed me she was in a band at that point. I heard some of that stuff, and I actually produced a demo for the band, and we started working together because her, you know, not only was she a genius singer, it turned out she was a genius writer as well. She was an absolute genius writer. And on we went from there. She sang on a couple of other tracks of mine, and eventually we got to the point where I was working on Addicted to Bass, and I kind of said to her, you know, I'd started constructing the music and the chord structure and stuff, and I said to her, do you want to help me write this song? And here's, I mean, the way I conceive it is the story of someone who's kind of, you know, it's like a drug problem, but their drug is bass, and they're really consumed by it, and they're over, you know, it's an addiction. I'd sort of written the first pre-chorus. You know, the first bit leading up to the first Totally Addicted to Bass, but not much more than that. So I sort of played her that and gave her something to listen to and work with, and she went away. And she came back, I don't know, a week later or whatever, with pages, you know, 3 pages, absolutely full of lyrics. Amazing. She brought back pretty much the whole song as we know it, lyrically. So I sat with her, and we, you know, there was too much material. We edited it and refined it down, sort of took a day refining it down and finding the story in the lyrics that she'd written, which was great. It was this amazing story because it's sort of the story of redemption, really, because you start off there really isolated and lost. You've got this hunger that you can't control, this addiction to bass, and then you're out in public and you feel ashamed by it. You know, you can't help it. And then eventually you look and you realise that everyone has this hunger and you're not alone, and everyone's, you know, got this addiction to bass. So that was amazing. That's sort of how it went, finding the singer. And again, you know, in the recording process when we did it, we did 4 takes, and I had just started working on sort of recording the vocals to hard drive before. I'd probably been doing that for a little while, but not, you know, only for a few months before that. It had been to 8-track tape recorder. So I recorded 4 takes of the vocals. You know, normally you do, these days you'd do 40 takes. 4 takes is nothing, but, you know, we just did 4 quick takes. Picked out the best bits, and that was it. That was the recording of the vocals. I remember when I was writing it, when I was sort of early. I mean, it took me about 3.5 weeks to create from start to finish. So I really, you know, savored it and worked. And that's a very long time. These days, I wouldn't work on one song for that long. But I guess I had the luxury to do it then, because I was playing in a band on weekends at that stage, in a cover band, playing bass guitar. So I could afford for the studio to sort of not be earning money, if that was what was happening for a while, if I was just working on my own stuff. And halfway through, I rang up, you know, the guy at Shock Records and played it to him over the phone, and it sort of had that brow now, now, but it didn't have the vocals on it yet. So I just sort of sang the wow, bit to him over the phone, and he burst out laughing. I said, well, I don't know if that would be vocals, that might be a double bass or something doing that boom, 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 boom line. I wasn't sure how to take it, that he'd reacted so strongly, but I thought, well, you know, he has reacted, and that's something, that's probably something good. And I think that I probably thought of the Wahoo Wahoo because there was a song, you know, Video Killed the Radio Star, which had the ooh wah, ooh wah. So I just sort of, I think that, and I love all that 80s synth pop, all those sort of 80s synth one-hit wonders. That's the music that is my favourite. So I think the Wahoo Wahoo is a bit of a ooh wah, ooh wah in reverse, in some ways. And also at the end of the verse, when I go into the pre-chorus, it goes standing by the stereo. It's got those 3 claps, and that was very much an 80s thing. Obviously the Flying Lizards, I Want Your Money, but there's a lot of songs that have that, so it just seemed natural to me to put in that device as a turnaround, as a device to get from the chorus, from the verse, from the end of the verse into the pre-chorus section. So I think, you know, it is an interesting thing that people often said to me, you know, for a song that's all about bass, it's actually not, it doesn't have a lot of bottom end, which is true, I'd sort of laughingly thought, oh, that's funny, it doesn't have much bottom end. But actually in the second verse, from the second verse onwards, there's a sub-bass that comes in underneath the bass line, which is very, very low and very subby and very subtle, that you don't really even notice listening sort of through the radio or on the home stereo. But when I was touring you know, for the sort of couple of years that I was touring, I guess in 99 and 2000, or 98, probably between 98 and 2000, when I had, you know, I was touring all around Australia. I did the Big Day Out tour with Danielle. And particularly on the Big Day Out stage, I realised that when that sub bass came in from the second verse, there was actually massive bass, but you needed speakers big enough to do it, to sort of reproduce it. And it was, you know, kind of big enough to make you kind of wobble across the stage when you're DJing. So yeah, that's kind of the story of Addicted to Bass. And then of course, you know, it kind of did its thing here. I mean, its lifetime here was really in the year of 1998. And it was every stage of its success was amazing to me. It was surprising and amazing because I was used to getting kind of triple R, you know, community radio support. And then I'd always been played really well on community radio. I started to get played, some of my tracks were being played on the small independent dance stations, like when Kiss FM started in Melbourne, they'd play my stuff. And then Triple J played the last couple of releases from FSOM, so they were supporting us a bit. But then Triple J really picked up, which is Triple J is the Australian, you know, ABC youth radio station. It's played, it's a national station, so the whole, played across the whole country. And they really flogged the first single off my album that had Addicted to Bass on it. They really flogged Thrill Seeker, which was a Big Beat track. So that was, you know, I knew I had them on board, but I still didn't know, you know, were they going to like this Addicted to Bass, which was much more poppy, really, compared to Thrill Seeker, which doesn't have any vocals. And they did start playing it, and they started playing it a lot. And then it was, you know, Song of the Week, then the album was Album of the Week. It sort of went on and on. And then commercial radio started playing it at night time, and I was, oh, that's good, never had that before. And then they started playing it at daytime, and I thought, oh, gee, that's good, and then they started flogging the hell out of it. And, you know, every stage was amazing to me. As it climbed up the charts, I just was kind of surprised and amazed, because if you take away the vocals, it's a very hardcore, you know, techie drum and bass track. And that just had not been played on commercial radio before, or hardly been, well, it hadn't really been played on Triple J at that point. So that was all really pleasing and amazing for me. And you know, it opened so many doors, dude. I did so many gigs. And it was a very interesting thing also, in that because it was as much pop song as it was dance music, I got a lot of gigs where I was on the stage after rock bands. So it was sort of an unusual situation being in that context, but it was great. And then, you know, when it had its life in Australia, a few years later, we finally got it released in the UK. It was a very annoying, you know, the legals were a pain in the ass, and after it was signed and we had this great record deal finally, and then getting them to actually get off their ass and release was a nightmare. But finally in 2001, they released it, and it went to number two in the UK charts, and, you know, sort of went to top of the dance charts all around the world, really, when they released it. So that was pretty amazing too, having that whole second life. And that was released as Pure Tone, not, you know, I just decided, given that I had a sort of second chance at a new life to the song, when they announced it on radio here, you know, they really struggled with my name and they found it impossible. So, you know, it was released here as Josh Abrahams featuring Amiel Damien. And they'd say Josh Abram featuring Emil Doolman, and they just couldn't get the names right. So I just thought, there's got to be a way to make it easier for the radio announcers. So, you know, we started looking for a name, and it's very hard to find a good band name because all the names have been used. And if any record has ever been released ever under a band name, you can't use that band name because you're trading as their trademark, effectively. So it took a long, long time, and for a while I thought of Apotec, which is Dutch for chemist, basically, which I thought was sort of funny and cool in a kind of rave way. And I think it was Amiel who came up with Pure Tone. We just had tried so many things and were playing with so many words, and I thought Pure Tone was great, because the Pure Tone is a thing in the studio, in technical sonic terms, basically a Pure Tone sine wave. Which is the simplest type of sound wave, is a pure tone sine wave. So I thought that was pretty cool, and it was easy to say. So we went, and it hadn't been used before, most importantly. So we went with that, and that did turn out to be much more easily marketed, I guess, than how the way it had been released here. The great thing about Addicted to Bass for me, one of the great things, there were many great things, but, you know, someone told me a story about how they were down at the beach one summer's day, and a mum and their little kid came walking up, and the mum was saying to the little kid, "Look, I'm just so sick of it. Will you just stop it? Stop it." And the kid, little kid, like 5 years old, looked mischievously at their mum and goes, "Wow, and runs off. You know, it had gotten into the kind of national psyche that much. People were constantly coming up to me at gigs and all over the place and saying, "Look, I don't like that music. I don't like electronic music. Man, that song's just amazing. I love that song." I had that all the time. It really did seem to cross a lot of genres and kind of, I guess, break barriers in some ways. So I couldn't think specifically of any one person who, out of context, who played it, but kind of everyone. I just really did have that thing. People were telling me that all the time. You know, my mum liked it. This was not easy with the techno I'd been doing kind of in the past. It is interesting. In one of the very early interviews I did for the album, I guess, and for Addicted to Bass, one of the interviews was with a sort of small Melbourne techno magazine, and one of their questions was, "Do you feel that you sold out doing a pop song with vocals?" And it was an interesting question, you know, coming from the context of where I had been, which was techno, pretty hard techno and acid house and whatever. And I, you know, at the time I said, "No, I don't think so. If it gives me the opportunity to reach a wider audience, then great." And it certainly did. I think that really constantly I found people who were surprising, who were into it. When the UK version of Addicted to Bass came out, Sony Independent Network Europe, Sign Records, which was a sort of offshoot of Sony, they kept coming to me with all these remixes they wanted to do, and one of the things I would find out was how much remixes were going to cost, and they were astronomical. I didn't really know the names. I wasn't really in the scene, you know, so much. I didn't really care about who was who and who was new and fresh and whatever. I just cared about what I liked, really. So, you know, they came to me probably somewhere between 5 and 10 times and said, "Look, we've managed to get this hotshot whoever to agree to a remix. It's going to cost..." I mean, I think the most expensive one was something like £10,000 or £15,000, and that was, you know, the dollar was half a pound then. So you're talking $20,000 or $30,000 for one remix. I thought, God, it's going to have to be gold. And they'd play me the remix. You know, one of them was very expensive, and it was really basically a pretty average drum loop with a very nothing bass line, and I think 3 word samples from the, you know, "Standing on the corner," something just like that, just that much. Just 3 word samples from the song. And there was even a dropout halfway through in the DAT. Like, there was an error, you know. It was horrible. And I just said, "You can't do that. You can't do that. I can't spend money." And they said, and the woman, you know, from Sign Records said to me, "I think you need to trust me on this. This guy is hot. It will get on every compilation. It will push the name of this song so far." So I just said, you know what, okay, fine, I'll give up. And I trusted them. And actually, one of the remixes that I really hated, which was a full vocal version of the song, but sort of slowed down to kind of house tempo, different gear remix, basically a club version of the song. I really didn't like it at the time because the vocals were stretched and slowed down so much, it made the singer sound like he was on morphine or something. But I have to say, the last probably 10 years, if I play that song out, that's the version I play, because it's actually a really great house tune, and he's built it really well around the vocal, and it's just a great tune. So I am very grateful for that mix. I really like it. The others, you know, whatever. I liked them or didn't like them at the time, but the good, and I was very grumpy about how much they cost, but I have to say that the woman from Sony Independent Network Records was exactly right. It got me onto so many compilations. All those different versions went onto, must have been 100 different, you know, dance compilations around Europe that summer of 2001 in Europe. And Sure, it meant that I never saw, I really never got any money for my recording royalties. You know, I never paid off, I never got the, whatever, they pay you in advance, and it never covered the cost of the advance and all that. But, you know, every time it sold on a compilation CD, there was the publishing income. So basically, it was amazing. It was a brilliant decision to get all these hotshot names and get me onto all these dance compilations. Get the release so much because the publishing payback was remarkable. So thank you, Sign, for making that annoying decision on my behalf. It still gets played on the radio in Australia all the time, and people are always saying, "Oh, I heard your song on the radio the other day." So you know, it's nice, and it really feels like I was in a very lucky position to have an impact. There's certainly a strong impact on the kind of Australian and New Zealand musical landscape, and even global to some extent. And that was, you know, that was great. That was a really good fun thing. And the fact that kind of everyone remembers it fondly. I've never had anyone say to me, "I didn't like that song." So that's a very nice thing. I am constantly talking to people about doing a new version of Addicted to Bass, particularly when, you know, bass music became a thing, a term. It seemed like the obvious thing to do, and really honestly, the issue has been time, because as more and more over the years my music has become my day job, I don't really honestly have time to kind of be an artist anymore. And I guess particularly to take risks, because, you know, now I'm a family man, and, you know, got a little kid and another one on the way, and you know, being an artist is very risky financially, and even if you do have success, it kind of takes about 2 years before you see any money in your hand, from when you're making the song, between 1 and 2 years. So now the way it is, I get to do music every day, and I'm doing great music for a wide range of projects, a lot of really creative, and you know, get paid straight away. There's no risk of is it going to be a hit, and is it? So whilst I would love to do it, and I absolutely plan to do it, and you know, I've probably got two or three labels lined up at the door who would put it out straight away, it's actually about finding the time for, you know, I wouldn't say a frivolous project, but for something that is some level of risk compared to just sort of doing my job every day.
What about if someone came along and had already done a great remix for you? Would you kind of give them the nod and go, "Okay, cool"?
Look, maybe. There's levels of label involvement and stuff that I would have to go through. I've re-signed the publishing to the publisher, who was the music publisher for it back at the time, which is Mushroom Records. Mushroom Music Publishing. There'd probably have to be some approval process there and whatever. But yeah, sure. Look, interestingly, it's never happened. There's certainly cover versions on YouTube, on iTunes, and they are invariably horrible. Except for very recently, a Sydney bluegrass band called The Pigs did an album of sort of tribute covers to 13 Aussie, you know, great Aussie hits, and one of them they did was Addicted to Bass. And they actually brought me in on the recording process. I got to play the tuned bottles and do a bit of a hee-hee-hee halfway through it. And that's great. I love that version, and that's going down very well, being very well received on YouTube. But yeah, interestingly, no one has done kind of any. I mean, the a cappella's out there, so, you know, people haven't come to me with the remixes yet. So I haven't had to consider that.
The first ever electronic music show on Hauraki. This is In It for the Kicks, 10 till midnight Friday nights. Radio Hauraki.